Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, host of The Big Story, Canada's longest-running daily news podcast. For 6 years now, we've been telling one story a day, every one of them about something that matters to Canadians. This spring, though, we're going deeper. The Big Story presents Pay Dirt, the inside story of Ontario's Greenbelt scandal. From political games to stag and doe parties, endangered species, RCMP investigations, and Las Vegas massages, you will hear the full story straight from the people who broke it. The Big Story presents Pay Dirt. New episodes every Monday starting April 22nd, and you can get them all by following The Big Story wherever you get your podcasts.
Find your frequency.
Controversial subjects with the facts can be tense, but we are a sub-science here to make things make sense.
Today we're talking about funny. We're talking about what makes something funny, whether or not, and how we decide when a joke is quote-unquote too soon, and whether or not jokes and humor can be used to learn better.
That was cruel. That was chaotic.
I tried to do the RuPaul app.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. Okay, let me try.
Oh, yeah, like what? How else does he love? No.
Well, that- Michelle. I can't do it. Michelle Visage.
What is he? It also reminds me, I used to be able to do a dolphin really well. Like,
oh my gosh, that turned me on. So why is that?
Because you're into bestiality.
Whoa, and our dog appeared. Oh my god,
a lot's happening. Okay, so how's it going?
Okay, so we're starting the podcast. How is it going?
I'm Mitch,
and I'm Greg,
and we're ASAP Side Note Podcast.
Oh my god, we have that
sighed at me, like literally. He's like, stop, take me for a walk.
No, Mitch and I can do really well here. Let's do it.
Hey, I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're ASAP Science.
Whoa, isn't that wild?
Was it fun?
I could even watch this. I'm Greg.
And I'm Mitch.
And we're ASAP Science. We could do that all freaking day.
We've probably said it about 1,000,000,000 times.
8.5 years, that's what we've learned to do. If you if you actually just come up to us and go, who are you? We just go, I'm Greg.
Yeah. And there's also it. Like so many times at events, we have literally like not the same spiel, but we know. There must be a phrase for this. Like, there's words or phrases that I will come to that signals that it's your turn to talk.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, I'll be like, and then Greg was actually in teacher's college.
Yeah.
And I stopped
Mitch
there.
Was actually an editor and was friends with people who knew how to do YouTube.
And so we both were on this weird spectrum. Okay, what are we talking about?
And Hello. Really, it's like, I'm actually like, and Mitch was in a call.
Oh, my gosh. Some of them might listen to this and watch this.
Yeah, listen to I Have to Call My Sister podcast if you want to hear about how Mitch was in a call.
Yeah.
But I will say that kind of has to relate to comedy because we also have like our quote unquote
a comedy cult.
No, for when we do our like spiels and our interviews, like we do have our like one liners that we know work through. Like we have our little equivalent of a routine. Like if you watch comedy, or I have been doing stand up comedy again before comedy died when the coronavirus hit. And you watch comedians do the same jokes over and over, and it's like, what makes a good comedian in many ways is saying a joke in a way that makes the people in the audience think it's the first time they said it.
Right.
And we do have our little routine down where like people probably think we're saying it on the spot, but you're like, we try and hide the peas and the carrots or whatever. The peas. You're like, we hide the peas in the carrots and the mashed potatoes. Like, that's what science is. We hide the science in the pun or whatever.
But I'm not funny. I am. You get all the funny lines.
You're funny. What do you mean?
No, I think I've like slowly learned my only humor.
Oh my God.
What?
Okay, sorry. Like my
also,
only
also, when
humor.
You were, I just have to pause because I'm petting the dog and I almost kissed the mic because I every time I pet him, I want to kiss his face.
Oh God, I want to lick his face.
Okay, going too far every
I want to like make out with his face.
So I think I'm not a funny person. I don't think of funny things that easily. But I think I know what's funny about myself is that I am so anxious and neurotic. But that's... I don't get to laugh at that part.
Okay.
It's actually very intense and scary for me. Okay. But like, I know in retrospect, it's funny, but I'm like jealous because you can make jokes and laugh at the same time.
Okay. I think that you are funny. I think that you don't give yourself enough credit. And I think...
I was actually on Big Brother and someone called me them without a personality. So
wait,
that stuck
what?
With me.
Called you what?
Tim was like, he's me, but without a personality.
Are you serious?
That stuck with me.
That's so mean. I hate him.
Well, he didn't say it to my face. I saw it when I watched the show.
That was like something he said in a confessional?
No, he said it to somebody else.
Wow. Well, Tim actually had a little bit too much of a personality.
Oh, he's a sociopath.
Yeah, it's like that's also...
That's too much of a personality,
you sociopath. Anyways, wow, now I'm angry. But okay.
Oh, you just got so defensive. That's nice.
Because I think humor is so interesting and like... Yes, I think a certain part of being funny is also about taking things not super seriously and like having like a lightness and also maybe even like trusting yourself a bit. And I think it's like, I don't like the fact that you're able to confidently say you're not funny is probably part of the reason why you struggle with whatever you think it means to not be funny. Because I think you are really funny. You can say really funny things and I think you take things seriously. And I think that you have you don't trust yourself.
It's that, but I also have such a bad memory. So it's really hard for me to recall things quickly. So, and I know that's just one style of humor, like to be able to on the spot come up with jokes.
Yeah, that's not
definitely a skill I have. I am not close to in proximity.
But
at all.
How much of this is a narrative you've built for yourself?
No, of course, partially, but it is honestly true. Like, I think. And this is not true at all. But I think if I tried to write funny jokes, eventually I could. Obviously, you have to go through the whole process.
I really think you could because it's more of a science than you realize.
Exactly. I think intellectually I could come up with jokes, but not on the spot. I think I need the time to reflect and edit and all those things, which I know most people do. But there are people who I think you are genuinely funny on the spot. You're quirky. You're weird. You say things that are like you're much more quick with.
But I don't necessarily think that. One thing I do think though, that even just like before this podcast, I'm going to lay out some things like what I think people think of me as funny, but it is a part of humor. And we're going to really get into this today, but I don't necessarily think I'm super quick witted, especially like hanging out with comedians. I know people who are really quick witted, but one thing is I know I don't take life or myself very seriously. I have a scientific mind. I think we're all gonna die. And like, I think I take things with breath. And I do sometimes notice that you don't. Like sometimes you get really, really upset about things and like you can get really triggered to the point where like even before this podcast you got upset about something and I was like, how the hell could that make sense?
And my only opportunity for funniness is my anxiety.
No, and I'm saying it is really funny and endearing. And I'm like, I don't think it's true. I think you've like built something for yourself. And I even think you don't like with life and with age, like I think you will become less serious. I might become more serious about life. Like these things are all in flux.
Perhaps.
And I don't think it's smart to build a narrative for yourself at the ripe age of 32 that like you.
Ooh, ripe it is. Ripe
people,
it is.
People can learn to be funny. We are going to talk about the science of humor and funny today. It is in many ways, a methodology. It's a craft that people can create. You can hone it. It's a muscle. So I think that this is an interesting opportunity for you. I don't want you to say that about yourself anymore because it's not true. Okay. And you can change it if you want.
I'm so funny.
Yeah, there you go.
I'm so funny.
Into that.
I'm so
funny. You are funny. Also, it's all subjectivo.
Yeah, but like it's not subjective. Okay, no, let's get into
okay, okay. That's like actually the other part. We told you.
Let's go into the podcast.
Oh, what did we learn this week?
So I am still on this kick, having finished this book, Fashionopolis, coming back to it a lot, trying to figure out how to purchase clothes. I think I kind of have always really been interested in fashion as an expression, like a kind of what we were just talking about. I don't care what people think. And in a certain way, obviously everyone cares what people think, but I value not caring what people think. And I use my fashion as a way of like coding and signaling that to people. Like I kind of wear what I like. I don't like to like follow trends. Like I just wear what I like. And I think people will be like, oh, I don't think that people would necessarily say Greg has a good fashion sense, but Greg dresses the way that like he wants to.
Sure. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I think you have a good fashion sense, but there's that element of, okay, that's kind of like odd, but he's obviously comfortable in it.
Yeah, like these, I bought this because it has puff sleeves and like, that's kind of weird. But so I'm like, I think I've always felt that fashion was something.
A puff for a puff. See, it took me like 10 seconds to get there.
But I don't even know what you're talking about. That's cool. You're smarter than me. What?
A puff is a gay person in England.
Oh, a puff. Oh, yeah, puffa. Like from Billy Elliot. Oh, yeah, puffa.
Yes.
I meant more like Anne of Green Gables. Like, I want puff sleeves. But so I really did, I think, value fashion for a while. So I've had this like reckoning where like dealing with the climate crisis, consumerism, like, okay, I want to be able to dress the way I want to without ruining the world, aka I'm only shopping secondhand, but learning a lot about there's going to be ways that we can evolve the fashion industry. Mm-hmm. But what I didn't realize was that denim was dyed with synthetic indigo. Okay, so indigo. I'm like, huh, indigo. Like, to me, that's a color. Like, I paint.
To me,
like,
that's a bookstore.
To me, that's a Canadian bookstore. That was quick.
Okay. It's
girl, she's quick. Oh, my gosh.
Just a few drinks.
Turn to leaf. Yeah, that's true. Alcohol. Are you kidding? Every comedian's two drinks in when they're on stage. So, indigo, the dyeing of denim initially came from a plant called Indigofera tinctoria, which is a plant. Oh. There's also Japanese varieties, which are different. And what they would do is ferment the leaves to uncover the blue dye, which is known as indotin. And like, it's really interesting because like, it's a plant. It blooms, like butterflies come, like bees come. Like mm-hmm. it was a very like, you're essentially growing a crop. Then you ferment it and you got this rich, rich dye, which technically
that
now
is indigo.
That is indigo. Cool. Well, and that is how you would dye jeans, originally dyed denim when they started to make jeans in America. It's a very when you see like the
so
denim
they soak
outfit.
Denim in that color.
Yes. And it comes from
so
a plant.
What color is denim before? What is denim? I don't
it's cotton.
Know what denim. Oh,
it's just cotton. Yeah. It's processed cotton. It's really just cotton. So then you need to add this color. And then there's also all these horrible things they do to make it like ripped and like, okay. like washed and all these things. Weird. But now 99.99% of the indigo that goes into denim is synthetic and it has cyanide in it. It's made of petroleum. It's just like this awful substance.
It's probably cheaper and faster.
It's cheaper and it's faster, but it's based off of this idea that obviously back in the day where
it's in nature.
It's a plant. And the leaves, if you watch videos of it, it's fascinating. It like if you even just like dry the leaf or like hold it for long enough, it starts to like turn this rich, rich color. So that is just one thing is that some companies in America and in every country you live in, you can probably find places where people are actually dyeing things with natural dyes. Like, I never really knew what that meant.
Yeah.
But it's like, oh, it's a
freaking
source plant.
In nature.
And it's like these plants also, the indigo plants or where you get indigo from, they're not attractive to pests. So you don't have to use pesticides. Like, there's all these like benefits that I'm just like, ugh, like, I'm only going to shop secondhand. But if I ever decide not to, which I don't want to, but if I do, I'm going to be like, okay, I want it to be made from an indigo plant. And there are some companies who are trying to get Levi's to buy into this. Like, why not? Like, just charge more. Can't you picture it, right?
You probably need farms and crops growing this stuff.
Yes, but then you can actually ferment and get this indigo color. And then you can actually process it to become a powder and to become like a really concentrated liquid to then ship it across the world. Like it's still as much as it takes more like plants and it's like not made of petroleum and easier and cheaper. There are still ways to like move it and process it.
That's cool. No, it would be. And I could see that also being trendy because this is where my brain always goes, is obviously to move people culturally in terms of how they're going to change their habits. You kind of have to move culture as well. You have to make it interesting, make it cool. And I think there is something cool. Obviously, we've seen like free range chickens and fair trade coffee. And I don't want to say those are not good things. It's just like there is a trend to them.
Yeah, people are we're at a point in time where people are willing to make these types of purchases. I think it's about educating people. Like I picture you walk into like where you get your Levi's or whatever. And it's they like have their Levi's.
Genuine color Levi's.
They show you like behind on the billboard is maybe like a quick diagram about indigo. It shows you like a field of the indigo plant. And then it just is like, these ones are dyed with this plant. You're going to pay an extra $20 to $30.
Girl, make it.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I'm just sitting at home reading a book. Okay. I don't have the skills, but I know people are doing it. That's and then cool. I was like getting really into this and like looking at like natural dyes and stuff. And there's other ones, which is like black walnuts can be used to make muted browns out of cotton. Hmm. And then there's also this plant called madder, which is like a herbaceous perennial
madder?
That can. Yeah. M-A-D-D-E-R. Oh. And it can create like cranberry red colors. And I just was like, that is so interesting. Like, obviously, cool, yeah. We always dyed our clothes back in the day with plants.
Yeah, like, one time, like, of actually, course. I was going to dye my shorts are faded black. And then online, I read that you just soak them in used coffee grinds.
Like that, I'm so
and
into
then,
that.
And then they like go dark again.
Wow. And that's another thing that this book is talking about is like being able. Yeah, it's like we're doing that tonight.
Next summer, it's shorts.
Yeah. But being able to really opening yourself up to understanding like, okay, if something breaks, how do you fix it? Which you would be so good at because you love to fix things. Like learning about how your products are made, like how your clothes are made. That's a great example of being like, oh, I could dye my shorts with coffee. These are all things that we can think about doing before we throw something out. And yeah, mostly what I learned this week is about natural dyes. And like that That's to cool. me was a word last week, but then this week it became like a real thing. Mm. Still going to only shop secondhand. But I'm going to keep my eye out for like natural dye companies. And I hope that that trend picks up.
Amazing.
Your turn.
Okay. This week, I found out that your brain and the universe are a lot more similar than we previously thought.
Okay, dun, dun, I was like Neil deGrasse Tyson talking over here.
Well, if you picture it, picture what a universe looks like. Picture what the neuronal networks in your brain look like and start to think, huh? I know there's a lot of, okay, we're not getting into this
I'm like
idea.
Literally pretending I'm like, yeah, but I'm like in my head, space like, and the universe is so different than my brain, but I'm trying.
No, I just mean think of like not the empty black space, like think of the stars and all of the stars and like how you picture nebulas and what that looks like and the connectedness between
oh,
it.
Oh, wow,
And
true.
Then picture like neurons connecting and the colors and the connections of that.
True. All the neuron ones are like on paper drawings that I've done. Like it's all just like the way I draw cell biology.
It's like,
and
it's so like,
it's
cartoon.
So it's literally on a whiteboard. It's the opposite of space, but yeah.
So a research paper was literally just published about this by, I believe, an astrophysicist and a neurosurgeon who worked on it together. And
talk about a couple of smart people.
Yeah, they were using basically algorithms and math to compare these structures and the organization of brains and stars in the universe. Which I was like,
in
that's
stars?
Pretty cool. Or just the makeup of, yeah, how stars and galaxies organize in the universe.
I guess those are the main things.
So, obviously, one of the major differences is the scale that these things are happening at. And so, even the forces that are working on them are very different. So, that's why it was curious. It's okay, we can kind of see that they maybe look similar. Obviously, there's major differences in why they would structure this way. But here are some things that they found. So, you know, your brain has around 69 billion neurons, and the universe has about 100 billion galaxies. In both, only 30% of their masses are composed of galaxies or neurons. So your brain is 30% neurons, the universe is 30% galaxies.
So it's really like this neuron galaxy comparison.
It's neuron. Yeah, exactly.
In the expanded
galaxy neurons arrange themselves in long filaments or nodes between the filaments.
This is spiritual. Sorry, keep going.
70% of the distribution of mass or energy is composed of components playing an apparent passive role. Water in the brain and dark energy in the observable universe.
Oh.
Very cool. And so basically, the connectivity within the two networks evolves following similar physical principles, despite that they're obviously in very different like
conditions. I love how we have to keep doing the caveat like, but they're obviously, it's like, yeah, I know. No,
that's what makes it interesting. So we're not at all, this study was not trying to also suggest, because there's obviously sort of the Men in Black analogy at the end where it's like a galaxy, they roll out and it's like aliens playing with marbles. Do you remember that?
That was like something that I feel like directors in Hollywood threw in that truly like became a
change culture,
a philosophical mind-blowing moment for our generation, I think.
Yeah.
Like, I remember being, like, an annoying kid being, like I was always been obsessed with science, but, like, when this came up at a young age, being, like, but what if we're a marble? You know what I mean? Like, but what if we're just in a marble? Like, it came, like, a moment where you could say that to someone, and they go, oh.
And that kind of idea is not what this is saying, in the same way that it's not. There's these cool, you know, you can philosophically think, like, what if the universe is just a brain of another being, and that we're all just like these, like, parts of a bigger creature, and that our brain is like actually like a whole,
like the other little universe. Adrenaline molecule in our body is like someone's existence. Yeah.
And that's not what these researchers were trying to say, but ultimately the kind of bottom line was that the universe and the brain structure shows more similarities. So there's more, let me put it this way. There's more similarities between cosmic web is what they called it, and a galaxy or a neural network and inside of a, what did I write here? I'm like,
I literally was closing my eyes and was like, yes, tell me.
I'm like, I need
anything you would have said in that moment. I would have been like, yes.
Okay. This is the, I'm rereading it. I understand. So what we're talking about, the universe and the brain, is more similar than what you see between the difference of the cosmic web and galaxies or the neuronal network and inside of a neuronal body. So what that basically means is that it's not like this pattern is everywhere. Like, your brain to its structures, it's not like everything in your brain follows this similar pattern. So that's why they found it interesting. Like, statistically, the universe and the brain followed these interesting patterns that match, that are not necessarily ubiquitously found in every other natural thing.
Okay, that made sense right as you said that at the end. So, like, but prior to that, prior to that, I was like, girl, I don't know.
Well, I started thinking about it, and there are, and this is just like anecdotal, and my thought is thinking, you know, there are other examples that we can look at about how, like, trees kind of look like lungs, or they follow those same patterns of, like, your bracteoles and, like, breaking down into all these different branches, and then that's, like, where they're getting and exchanging their gases, you know?
Well, so, isn't it, like, it's, like, surface area to volume ratio, like, nature in and of itself follows patterns.
Yeah, we hear about a Fibonacci sequence.
Exactly. And, yeah. I do think that nature and science is spiritual in many ways. I think that's, for me, part of the reason why I love it. I think one reason why I love science and nature, or science, I guess, in general, is that I'm a critical thinker, and it, like, allows me to feel like I'm absorbing as much of this world as I can while alive. Mm-hmm. But the other part of me is that I genuinely find it spiritual. I think the more I learn about any aspect of physics or science or biology or chemistry, it just makes me feel more connected to nature, to how this plant works, to how that table got there. Like, to me, that is spirituality. And this is just kind of a beautiful, it just fits into that really beautifully. Like, this organ, like this, you know, pillowcase size organ that's folded up in my head, is the only thing that gives me a consciousness, that gives me the only meaning in anything. So I would love to compare it to the expanding universe. That's spiritual to me.
Yeah, yeah. There is some beautiful ways to think about that. I agree.
And that's all, like, I'm ever trying to do with science, is like search for spirituality within it, because I think it kind of has like the most validity for myself and my life, in my opinion.
Well, that's a beautiful way to
I'm end crying.
This segment. We're all crying. All right. I'd say we get into the episode.
About laughing.
Study time.
Study time.
Study time.
Study time.
Okay, wait, let's try and do our most realistic laugh.
Okay, wait. Okay.
Of ourselves.
Okay. Just like you're actually laughing at.
Okay, wait, no.
Okay. Interestingly, I recently, this was not my study, but I recently was listening to a podcast about laughter and how so much of it is performative because that's socially ingrained in humans, because laughter can sometimes actually stand to not necessarily be funny, but to create social cohesion.
Okay.
Which makes sense, right? When you laugh at something that's not necessarily funny. I'm sorry.
Did
I'm
you know like, that laughter? On your no, no, no. Okay. Did you know that laughter emerged before language, and it was used to signal to others that things were okay and that danger was low? That now is a good time to play, socialize, and explore. Okay.
How did you memorize
that? No, but it's that was like the first thing I wanted to say was that laughter
is, well, I mean, likely evolved like before laugh, language. Monkeys met laugh
exactly, like, and it's showing like we are safe. It is beautiful. It is a beautiful biological cue to the people around you that you are safe.
I'm only going to throw in the caveat because sometimes, I guess I've always been safe, like, but sometimes I laugh at inappropriate moments when I feel high anxiety. I sometimes laugh.
Okay, so you're sadistic.
I guess I'm still safe in those moments. Yeah, like, if I ever actually felt in danger.
No one's laughing like when they're like truly scared. About to die. Like it's like, then people might be laughing at some existential like moment.
You know, sometimes something sad gets said or death. Like there's moments where you feel like, it's the anxiety, like laughter's a release.
Also, there's like, I always like doing comedy. I've truly only done it for 2 years, and I know people who do comedy and they've done it since they were like 15 and now they're 40, and they would like laugh at me even having any opinion on this. But
that's not true.
But I'm just, there's a lot of self-deprecation in comedy. It's actually like a toxic environment.
Greg,
but
look at me. You need to own that you are a comedian, that you
did a good job.
No, I just mean like, it's okay that some people can do it for 40 years and some people have only done it for 2, and that doesn't mean that you...
Okay, thank you. I will...
You're great at it.
Namaste, I am one. I really think that as you get to like do it more, it really is a good example of the fun being taken out of it. And I actually... have read two books about science books about humor, and they both end with a similar quote about how like, and the more you look at it, the less fun it is. So maybe we should leave it alone. Like it's like a really interesting, like
that's a little bit like everything, I think.
I know. But humor is
maybe not science, weirdly.
Okay. Oh my God, I'm so excited. So I think that comedy is extremely fascinating because I feel like with my science mind, there are so many things that we can define, even like the laws of nature, physics, but comedy is a really fascinating thing that doesn't follow tangible scientific norms. So we're going to talk today about like where we've got with science, but in general, it is subjective. Like I've always found art and creativity and comedy to be fascinating and beautiful as a science-minded person, because I'm like, that's where things start to fall apart.
Yeah.
Why does this book move me to tears? And like, why
and
does
also
this joke,
why would somebody else be so unaffected?
So
by
unaffected by it. Like, yeah. And I have noticed that. Like if I do the same joke over and over, it can like make people laugh so hard. And I'm like, it's just these 20 people in this room. Then the next night it can just be like people are literally like, what is he saying? Right. It's you see it happen all the time. Mm-hmm. But one thing I'll say about comedians and laughter, they don't it is sucking the fun out of it. Like if you say something funny in a group of comedians, they go, oh,
they're
good.
Judging it.
They're like, that's good.
Right.
Like it's like they're literally like, oh, that's, they're no
or just like,
no, it's not negative. It's like it's just
very
that's
objective
good.
And outside.
That's good. Yeah. Yeah, like that's good. That's a funny that's joke. So funny. Not all of them, and I think a lot of people have really strong relationships, but if you get in a group of comedians, there's this like interesting dynamic, which is really helpful for the creative process. It's not bad. And I really don't want you to say like it's out of jealousy or anything. It's just like,
joking.
It's just like, that's good. Like write that down.
Wow. Okay. You're getting defensive.
No, because I'm like, I don't want it to be like,
we're calling out all of Greg's comedy friends right now.
No, because I'm
one
like,
by one. Give me names.
No,
give me
comedy
names.
Comedy is toxic. And that's not the reason. The reason it's toxic is because it's like only men have been allowed to do it. And like only men were told they're funny. Even though according to studies, women laugh way more than men when reading jokes. And women also value humor more than men. And there's a bunch
of... And like only women are funny.
There's a bunch of studies by Richard Wiseman in a variety of ways that show that women are, if you want to, like, I will say it with confidence, are funnier than men and have more of a adept relationship with being funny, which is fascinating.
The alt-right's coming for us.
Well, only recently have women been allowed to do comedy.
Right. More like, unique perspective.
Yeah. And I just want to say, I'm not just saying that. Like, women... in studies laugh more at jokes and they value humor more. So it's like, okay, well, what does being funny mean? I'm pretty sure it's like laughing at jokes and not using humor.
Do you want to lead the charge on your study first, or do you want me to go first?
You go first.
Okay.
Mine,
I feel like yours might be more fundamental. Mine is related to...
What is the thing on RuPaul about fundamental?
Reading is fundamental.
Yeah, cool. But
reading is when you
honey,
read
people. What does that mean?
Oh, what do you yeah. mean? It's when you like get the glasses and you're like, Greg, your face is so red. I don't know. I could not be on that show.
Oh my God, do it. Read me.
Okay. No, like in the moment, those people plan. They all know they're going there. And, okay. they have nights to like think of their jokes and stuff. But it would be like, I just can't do it on the spot. See, I'm not funny. Okay, going into my study. See, anxiety. So basically, I was looking at the impact of humor on learning. And so there's some really interesting research beyond this even, but this is one particular study that looked into the effect of a professor or instructor telling jokes and what that did to people's learning abilities or what that did to their learning experience. So there were like a few 1,500 or 1,600 people in this study. And what the ultimate finding was that ultimately males and females have very different views of what is funny and also what is offensive is what they found. So 99% of the people who were asked said that they appreciate an instructor having humor as part of their lessons, which doesn't seem surprising, but you might not think that that many people would say humor is important.
But now that I think about it, I'm like, of course.
Yeah,
like,
think about the professors we loved.
Were funny.
They had moments. Like, of course they could be serious, but they could also just kind of step back.
Well,
and
they're
laugh.
Public speaking. They're like doing comedy, hopefully.
What they found in the study was that humor decreases stress and enhances a relationship between student instructor and the instructor and helps them to remember what was taught in class.
Yeah.
So specifically going into more detail of what the study found. So funny humor tends to increase student attention to course content, instructor relatability, and student sense of belonging. So obviously a very powerful tool for an instructor, a professor, a teacher to use in their classes. In a great way, in a lucky way, unfunny jokes don't have a negative impact on learning, which is awesome. So if you're not that funny as a teacher, you could still take the risk. You're not negatively impacting your students.
So many grown teacher jokes are so cute and the kids love it.
Exactly. Like they know they're trying to be funny. I think it's endearing even if it's not funny.
Yeah.
The risk, the big caveat, offensive jokes impact student learning.
Oh, God,
the problem
yeah.
is... What's males offensive? And females see what's offensive as completely different. So 40% of students said their ability to learn was decreased if a professor or an instructor said something offensive, like beyond even just the one course. Because obviously you start having trouble relating to them.
Oh my God.
And so men are more likely to think jokes about gender, sexuality, religious identity are funny, and women are more likely to find them offensive. Obviously, this is a scale and everyone's different, but in general, that's what they found. The three topics.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
They found were not offensive to anyone were science, college, and television.
College? Oh my God, like where they were at the time.
I don't know. I guess these were college kids.
Yeah, no, that is interesting.
But it made me think about being in school. And yeah, I think even though I wasn't necessarily like a funny kid or anything, seeing teachers.
Stop saying that.
No, but I mean, sorry. I was quiet. I was introverted. It wasn't like I was participating or volleying, as RuPaul would say 1 million times in RuPaul's Drag Race. You got a volley. Remember?
And I guess like I was truly like the loudest class cat.
Yeah, ever. I feel like you had a different experience because you probably engaged in that. I would like be a participant.
My teachers
as a watcher
hate like that I did well, but they really hated that I did well because I talked and was like so loud all the time and would disrupt the class so much. Like my mom hated going and my dad hated going. My dad actually stopped going
because
they would just be like, your kid is so disruptive and like, but he does well, so this is like the most annoying place to be. It's like, okay, yeah, cool, I can tell you your kid's doing well, but he's ruining it for everyone. I was like, oh my god. My mom would scold me. I used to hide in my room. I would like go in my room and open a book on parent teacher interviews so that when she'd bust in the light was on, I'm so like studious. Sorry, I'm actually just reading a mystery novel. I pretend I didn't know where they were.
Yeah, no, that we're so different. So I guess I was just saying before you interrupted.
Sorry. Volley, babe.
No, okay. I appreciated teachers who were funny and even who just like created that environment of levity in class.
Yeah, so
especially when it was a class like science, because it feels so stale sometimes.
So I am in quarantine, went a little bit chaos in the brain and wrote a screenplay. And it's actually about this because when I was a teacher, they told me that I needed to not act gay, not smile.
When you were what? In school?
When I was a teacher in the UK.
Oh, okay. I thought you said in high school. Yeah.
I taught at a school that was extremely challenging. I taught at schools all over Toronto.
It was also sort of like a small town.
Yes.
I guess I'm saying that because I think there is a large difference between being in a city and being in a rural area. In terms of like the cultural.
In Britain?
I would think so.
Yes.
Everywhere. Okay, like, in America, like, in Canada, in Britain, there's a massive difference politically, ideologically between cities. And this is one of the biggest divides of our times.
Okay. That's fair. But I want to like just be a little more careful and nuanced. Like I taught in at-risk, quote unquote, schools in Toronto.
Sure, there was like that.
The most incredible students. I you know what I mean? I went into environments that people were like, this is a rough school in Toronto. And it was like, the respect and the students there were unbelievable. Way, like, I don't know. Looking back, I'm like, were they exceptionally amazing? Because then when I was thrust into, yes, a small rural town in Britain with, I think, its own version of issues. It was like an at-risk school in Britain. It was like, I had never seen behavior like this in my entire life. It was wild. And I think it had so many, there were so many reasons why. In Canada, teachers are respected. They're paid really well. There was also a large multicultural diversity. So there was like this innate intelligence that comes with that to understand people, to empathize. When I went into Britain, these schools are homogenous and there's just this lack of respect. And I also think the whole school is designed to, it's like militant. They actually have.
And also,
No, say it.
I was going to say, weren't they also not categorized, but put into schools based on tests they had taken, right? So at a very young age, you kind of made it sound like you take a test and you go to a school based on your quote unquote intelligence.
Okay, so this is like part, like I do have jokes about this. I'm like, you'd think that Britain, like the head of colonialism, like would like, you know, like be a shining star for anything, but like the country's busted. Like their education system is horrible. And I think maybe because it's been around for so long, it's harder to change. I don't know what the reason is, but in this part of Britain, you do an exam in grade 7, and if you do well on the exam, you go to a grammar school. If you do bad on the exam, you go to a separate state school.
In grade 7.
It's like, what the hell did you know in grade 7?
Everyone dumb in grade 7.
Exactly. And then what they realize is it's a socioeconomic issue because people in grade 7 with rich parents, A, they have more free time, or they hire tutors and they're like, 4+4 is like, oh my God.
Or you're not gonna...
I was going to say 16. In my head, I was multiplying. But then I realized I said plus, and I fully panicked. 4+4 is 8. What?
Okay, so you didn't go to a grammar school.
4+4 is 16. Boom, I'm in a state school. You know what I mean? 4+4 is 16. I'm screwed. So it's awful.
All it was that symbol turning sideways.
And exactly. It's just like an X and then it's a plus. Like, I don't know.
It's kind of confusing, actually.
But then they, even when you're in that state school, they rate people. If you're a lower behavior or a worse student, they throw you into one class. Like, differentiation is this thing that.
Whereas here, that doesn't.
Does not happen.
In high school, there is the division of academic and.
Applied.
So.
But that's a choice that you can make. No one's telling you you have to do it. Like it,
but
either way,
you know,
it's like,
I know what you mean. Yes. If you're ambitious, and there's not an actual set in stone.
There's a lot of like top down hierarchical like fear based into the system. Anyways, these kids were so violent, and I was told to be stoic and not laugh and not come out and do all the things that I like in Toronto. Everyone's like, come out, like, make sure, like, you're like, like, literally, I was told, like, first day is like, come in and just open. Like, yeah, like, wear like a tweed shirt and be like, I'm gay.
Why
kids.
Tweed?
Like, just like, you were, it was just so like they want in the TDSB because it's gay. But
is tweed gay?
Yeah, girl, are you kidding? Go with the
times. What's tweed? Isn't that like woven fabric?
Yeah, it's gay. Oh, it's okay. Granola. It's queer. It's out. It's downtown Toronto.
That's queer canon.
Yeah.
Tweed is queer canon.
So then this truly happened to me once. I was playing a video, and I brought this into my screenplay, but this happened. I was trying to teach people about nuclear energy, and I was like, people, the kids. I'm like, okay, panicking. Like, I'm going to start with a YouTube video of a nuclear bomb and like be like, this is the power of this energy, but we're going to go into it. And it was one of those videos that was an explosion. And then at the end, like a scary face goes, nah! And like comes forward.
I love that. That's so me.
That's so, Mitch loves a scare. That's, he laughs so hard at a scare. Actually, your humor is
and
scare.
Even me, when I got scared, I'm like, good job.
Yeah.
You got me.
Yeah. Whereas I'm actually just scared.
You're like, I hate you.
I punch you in the face. I screamed like a little girl. I flew across the like classroom. I broke a beaker. Oh, that's so God. Like front of me. I truly fell over and dropped a beaker. The kids screamed and then they laughed so hard. And then I laughed so hard. And then we all laughed so hard. And I like, I'm not exaggerating. I just remember like one of the worst kids just being like, huh, and then like opening his book for the first time, like holding a pencil and being like, so what are we learning? Literally, I was like, I had this moment where the whole class was quiet.
They were like, we connected.
They were on me. They saw that I was like
a human.
I was funny. Like it was so funny that happened, like that I was like, this is nuclear energy. And then it just like, and it was powerful. And yeah. it was, that is exactly what
like
your study's talking
moment.
About. And it's also, I wrote it into the script being like, we can't teach teachers to like be these like evil stoic beings. I think it's antithetic to like learning. So that's just a really cool study.
I want to talk more about your study because I don't know what it is, but I also want to talk about the idea of like how I think that humor and laughter is such a social construct to actually connect people in a weird way. So
yeah.
I figured, like, why don't we go for a little break? We'll come back and we'll talk about your study.
And we're back.
Teach me about humor, Greg.
Oh, that felt wild. That was so weird.
Okay, tell me about what your study is about, and then we can ramble more about humor.
It's so interesting to talk about teaching and humor because I don't really think this applies, or it does apply, but I really think what you were saying, even making like a bad joke as a teacher that's non-offensive, is like going to help with learning. This is about sort of what makes people laugh, especially in sort of like a comedy setting, or like wanting to be open to like laughter or like comedy, quote unquote.
You mean like formulaically what makes people
laugh? Okay. Yes. And like what makes people think something's funny if they're with their friends or they're partying or they're like trying to have a good time, not like in a classroom setting.
Right.
Because what I have noticed has worked as someone trying to be a comedian in those settings falls under this thing called the benign violation theory. And I really think it is the closest I've ever really understood, especially from reading like science books about jokes, about how there could be like a scientific formula to it, that even you saying you self-identify as quote unquote unfunny, but you're really intelligent and you think deep about things, that you would be so funny if you used this theory to craft jokes.
Okay.
Like on TikTok or
give it to me. I need to know this.
So essentially,
why have you told this to me before?
Okay. So a good like analogy. It's so funny because I use these in TikToks and you actually notice they will do better if you do this. But the theory is essentially saying that what comedy is doing is helping people deal with issues that are taboo or hard to deal with, but like packaged in a way that makes it feel okay. And a lot of comedians like understand this. And if you actually dissect comedy, you'll see this happening. And I also think it's a lot of the reasons why you end up with a lot of male comics saying offensive things to us as queer people or to women or to people who are butts of jokes. And they're confused because they're trying to do this. They're trying to push the limit. They're trying to say, well, actually, I'm saying something offensive, right, but I'm encasing it in a safe place.
Right.
But it's not safe to women or it's not safe to queer people. So we're not finding it funny,
and
but men
like,
are.
There's probably a line for whatever you're about to talk about. It's like it's a fine line that you have to be smart enough to know where that line resides.
Exactly. And so benign violation. So there has to be a violation of something, like something taboo or something normal. But benign is you're putting it into a situation where it's like not actually bad. And they have to exist simultaneously at the same time. And that will make you laugh.
Okay.
And so a metaphor that I learned in one of these science books that I have kept with when I do humor is about tickling. So it's like, if your friend tickles you, you'll laugh. Mm-hmm. But if you're sitting on the subway and someone starts tickling you, you're going to be like, slap the hand away, be like, get off of me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, okay, what is that safe way that you can say something?
To tickle someone.
To tickle someone. And that's really challenging if you're standing in front of an audience of diverse people, diverse ages, diverse backgrounds. And that's why I really respect comedians who are like have this universal approach. And I think it's also why a lot of male comedians will speak to men and maybe make offensive jokes about women and queer people. And we're off on the sidelines going, we're not laughing, but they're laughing because it's safe to them. It's not affecting
them. It's not offensive. It's pushing a boundary that's not uncomfortable to them.
Yeah. So that's called the benign violation theory. Okay. And it really is interesting. Like, so like recently, I made a TikTok that people responded to and like people were just like, ha ha ha, like laugh, laugh, laugh. And it was that, audio that's like literally my life dance every single night. It's just like this catchy,
love that song,
amazing
don't know
song.
What the hell that song is, love it.
And the whole framework of that joke on TikTok is the benign violation theory. So it's this really upbeat song and people write on the screen the most morbid thing that has happened to their grandparent. Like one of them was someone who decided not to go to school the day that they dropped the Hiroshima bomb. Like they would have died in it, and then they survived cancer like 3 times, and now they're like a badass bitch or something. But it's like literally my life, and the woman doesn't know what is happening. Right. It's like literally my life, and there's like my mom, my grandma's amazing, like giving the peace sign. You're like, you're laughing because it's like that is so dark, but this song is so funny. And it's actually packaging this woman as like a boss.
Yeah, in a way that's acceptable. And you want to root for somebody who's made it through that.
And some of them are really dark. It's like when my, like this is like a trigger warning. It's like when my like, I actually don't even want to say it. They're like, it's like when my one parent murdered my other parent. And they're just walking down the street smiling, going like, literally my life. That's like the number one TikTok. Because it's like, it's shocking. But this person is laughing and it's like,
and it's there
that I was like, this is the benign violation theory like accelerated. This kid is like 14, she's showing you that she's laughing at it. I'm like, comedian, like, you know, like Louis CK, like,
yeah, I
like could
add
only do
Can
that
I add something. So I think what makes that so interesting, not necessarily that in particular, but I think a big part of comedy and just enjoying it in general is that in that example, people are being self-deprecating, right? Mm-hmm. So you're violating this idea, but then you're actually not being offensive because you have experienced it. And I think that is like what a more modern and nuanced version of this theory is.
And it's
is that before you could just like push the boundary. There were people who weren't gay making gay jokes because it was kind of taboo. It was funny.
And they were
but now it makes sense that you need to be gay because you can push the boundary of that because you actually live that experience. You're obviously for the most part. Obviously, there's a small percentage, but you're obviously not shaming your whole community if you're somebody whose parents killed each other, or if you're someone who has a grandma who's like experienced extreme things. Like, you're close enough to make those jokes that you're not just trying to hurt other people. You're being self-deprecating.
And I think, to be honest, like with comedy, it's like, yeah, when Chris Rock was saying those homophobic jokes, like, gay people didn't have a voice. They didn't exist at the time. Gay people exist enough now to be like, that's hurtful.
Yeah,
like,
at the time, it's also just not funny when, it's kind of like when someone, you can make fun of your family members, you can make fun of people you love, but when someone else does it, actually is like, that's mean.
And they were making fun of gay people for straight people. Or they were making fun of women for men. Mm-hmm. Like, Louis C.K. was making fun of gay people for straight people. I'm sorry, but like, not that many gay people would have been at a Louis C.K. Comedy show. Audience, yeah, and I wouldn't be surprised if the racial background of it was quite white, and I wouldn't be surprised if it was predominantly male. Like, because he wasn't having to grapple with the fact that the audiences who didn't feel safe in the benign violation theory of a Louis C.K. joke weren't at his shows. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's something that makes it really fascinating and touchy, and why we all talk about comedy in this way, because a group of dudes doing comedy for dudes, which happens all the time, and I go into these spaces all the time, they're making each other laugh, but they're sometimes talking about things that I'm sitting there like so offended. I'm like, this isn't funny to me, because you're making fun of me, or you're making fun of women who I respect more than you. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, that is like this like play out, and it's okay. Like, I think that part of the process of comedy is like figuring out where you fall and having to deal with the fact that maybe you got it wrong with the benign violation theory. But one other really tangible part of this study that I even wanted to really say was that with Laugh Labs, which was this study that they did over a year with 1.5 million responses about jokes and timing and all these things, they found that it has to be at least 17 days after a national tragedy before you can make fun of it and that people will laugh.
That's really short.
Yeah, well, it's like a latency period of, I mean, again, this doesn't mean that like you're making a bad joke about it, but it's like they found that they like
you could push
the boundary of humor about, say it was like September 11th, that was devastating, but if you had like a good take on it 17 days after, before people were able to go, this benign violation, like the benign part of this violation is starting to come into play. Mm-hmm. There is a certain point where things are too fresh that anything you say is not going to be benign.
Yeah.
And so that formula of the benign violation theory, I think, has worked for me whenever it's weird. It's like math. It's like, if you put in the work, or it will work. Like, sometimes when I will go to write a joke, like whether it's on Twitter, you just write whatever's on the top of your head. But if you stop, and I really think this is something for you, like, you would be good at, because you are a slow thinker, you are an intelligent thinker, that if you were to be like, okay, this is the thing I want to say, now let's think about the benign violation theory, I think you could write really like incredible jokes or TikToks.
I guess that's a weird part where I guess my brain tells me other people have that naturally, and that if I do it calculatedly, it's not real.
So that's
even if
not
other people
true.
Find it funny, but maybe that, yeah, that's a weird construct in my mind.
People, comedians aren't
funny.
Like, they're not necessarily
they're just
funny
spending
in real
the
life.
Time to figure
There's
it out.
There's a lot of comedians I know, and I like watch them on stage and I watch them off stage, and I'm like, oh my God, you're so funny on stage, and you're the same person you are off stage. You're just funny. Mm-hmm. Then there's other comedians, some of the best comedians I've ever seen live, who are so funny on stage, and then off stage, they're just like quiet and normal. And Kristen Wiig is an example.
Oh my God, I was literally about to say her name.
Really? That,
like,
I think
the same exact time I was like, and you said,
yeah, she's obviously so funny, but when you see her in interviews,
she's very a bit subdued compared to how funny she can be as a character.
She's intelligent,
and seems a little bit introverted, which is surprising for a comedian usually.
So,
which
I
obviously there are plenty of introverted comedians. I guess even on top of that level, though, like, not to bring it all back to me, is I guess I tell myself that Kristen Wiig has a brain designed for that and that she can think of funny jokes.
They went to school.
Yeah, I guess she's.
You have
time.
A degree in science and that's like true. Editing. Like my I have a degree in
brain
science
has been
art.
Primed to yeah. think about how to talk about and think about science broadly.
They went to the Groundlings. They went to school where someone was like, "Yes, and this is the benign violation." Like they get taught these things. And it seeps into their personalities, both on stage and off. So it tricks you maybe even to thinking that they're funny.
But not
funny.
Everyone who's funny went to school for it. But they must have just had the life experience to like create some sort of feedback loop where they practice that a lot subconsciously.
Subconsciously. And there is an interesting tension, I think. And like if they didn't go to school for it, they likely were taught it by their parents or their friends, or like even me as being like the self-identified / class clown, I got to play with like being
right,
funny.
I guess
more.
The people I'm thinking about aren't necessarily good stand-up comedians. They're just outgoing and funny as people.
And would only benefit if they were actually trying to be comedians from learning these things. Personally, it's like I learned so much from these books. Like I have so much I have to work on when it comes to being a comedian, but the things that have worked have come from things that I've learned. And I think a lot of people maybe want to pretend with art that it's about like a gift or a thing that you've learned. But that in my life has been debunked through my visual art degree, through my like attempts at doing comedy, through science. Like it's all about practice and time and learning.
Here's what I think then. I think at the end of the day that people who end up being really funny, anyone maybe could be, or maybe not anyone, but like there's that kind of idea that, you know, the path is there for someone who puts the time in to figure it out, and that the people who end up being funny are the ones who have this sort of propensity towards it. Because I do objectively, I'm like, I think if I spent 10,000 hours trying to be funny, I think
well,
I would
be Malcolm
funny.
Gladwell, we debunked that. But
okay,
continue.
But you know what I mean? Yeah. I'm saying that as a figure of speech. Like, yeah. I think if I spent hours a week practicing and writing jokes, I think I could make funny jokes.
Yes.
But there's then this other level underneath where it's like, but I don't want to do
exactly.
that.
Exactly. And I also don't. I'm like, I truly have like realizing like,
I'm not saying that
comedy.
It's not worthwhile. I'm just saying for some reason I don't.
Yeah. And that's totally fine. But, I think more what I would want you and listeners to take away from this is I think more you as someone who were like started by being like, I'm not funny. It's like, it's not black and white like that. And if you actually wanted to be, you could take a little bit of time to research and to learn and to practice, especially with the fact that you have to make TikToks and things like that, where TikTok is a really fascinating medium and so is Twitter. And now that you know benign violation theory, you're going to see it with viral tweets and viral TikToks. You're going to think, oh, wow, this whole beginning of this TikTok is making me feel safe. And at the last minute, they're going to throw something in that violates you. And then all of a sudden you're going to laugh and be like, that was so funny, or that threw me off, or but I still feel safe. Like,
that's so interesting.
It's not something you necessarily don't want to do when sometimes you're like, I have to make a TikTok about information I think is interesting.
I know. I don't know why there's such a disconnect for me. Maybe because I have feel like there's like layers on my own personality that are stopping me from doing
that. Yeah, and I think that is true.
I find it difficult because we live and work in this entertainment world. I have moments where I'm like, oh, but I'm weirdly like an introvert. And if I was left to my own devices, I would not. It's not that I wouldn't have a podcast. It's not that I wouldn't have a YouTube channel. I probably would do those things, but I wouldn't. I've been more recently wanting to do things more candidly. Like our podcast allows for that. I'm wanting to make our videos a bit more candid and less scripted because it allows people to see who you are, a little more vulnerability. Is that a word? Vulnerably.
Yeah.
But then I get insecure because I'm like, but I don't know that my talent is that. Like, I think my talent is to like really zone in on something and work on it hard and spend a lot of time and then present.
But that's what really incredible artists are doing. They're spending the time, they're doing that thing, and they're making it look effortless, which you do in many ways. But the mediums you just mentioned are ones that don't lean to that, like what we're doing right now, talking into a mic freely. Mm. And so I think that they're all going to benefit each other. And I don't think it's that black and white. And I think it's also something that, like, I mean, we know each other really well. And like in therapy, like you're working on, it's a worldview or a narrative you've told yourself that isn't necessarily true.
Yeah, I just debate if it's like, do I want to be that? Is it worth my energy and time to work towards that? Or
yes, probably, if you think about
why.
But wait, what do you mean work towards what?
Being funnier.
No, I'm not. Okay, I'm not even necessarily talking about being funnier in general. Because
like at the deep core, I'm like, I don't care about being funny.
Yeah, what I'm actually talking about when I'm specifically talking to you, this is
are
so
we
funny.
Having a therapy session?
When I'm specifically talking to Mitch into this mic, which is going to be broadcast to like tons of people, is that you are spending a lot of your time now as a quote unquote TikToker, as a quote unquote science communicator, as a quote unquote someone who has this like platform where you're trying to teach science. And you're always trying to think how, even like, let's go back to learning. Mm-hmm. How am I going to teach this well? It's like, it's not about
when you put it that way.
Am I going to try and be funnier? Like, of course, that's a psycho thing to say. Oh, I'm going to practice being funnier. Mm-hmm. But we know how important it is.
Right.
And we know the benign violation theory, and there are formulas to it. I don't think it would take you, especially as like a really intelligent person who learns quickly about things, that long to like heighten the things you're already doing to be quote unquote funnier. And you're not actually going to change. You're just going to make the content that you're making more funny.
Okay.
Did that make sense?
It did.
At the end of it, I was like, are you just fucking saying crazy shit?
No, that makes sense. That it is like it's a perspective shift.
You have some weird, like being funny, like thing that's like binary.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's not.
Well, I'm a binary person to begin with. So, yeah. Because I don't like the idea of saying this word I'm about to say, but I live in this sort of like purity spectrum in terms of like the way I view myself of like not wanting to do something that doesn't feel quote unquote authentic, right? I've even said this to you. Like I have a really hard time acting happy when I'm upset or being like exuberant when I'm sad. And so there's part of me that thinks like I am not a funny person, so I don't want to try and be funny.
Whoa, oh my God.
In the same way that all those other things cause problems for me, there's like this idea of like, what am I? And I need to be that authentically. And sometimes that stops me from like trying to do other things because I'm like, but I'm not that. But then it is just like, you get to choose what you are.
No, what's crazy, but in like in my therapy, now we're just getting deep. It's like that we've realized, me and my therapist, it's like I live my life so through the perspective of death and, like I said earlier about like my obsession with spirituality through science, like I'm always thinking about death or I'm always thinking about life and death. And like me being alive, I think is just the most beautiful thing. And through that worldview, I am obsessed with experiencing and like, this is going to simplify it, but like conquering fears. So it's like when there is something like to learn, like what you're saying, you're like, I'm like, oh, I'm not good at that. I'm not going to do it. It's like, if I'm not good at something, I'm going to do it because while alive, that is what a beautiful thing to do to enhance my life. And so it's like, if you notice,
we're
it's like
so different.
I know. It's like, so it's like, oh, painting. It's like, okay, I'm going to get a degree. I love science. So I'm going to get a degree in science, but you know what? I also like I'm really creative. I also need to do a degree. Like people weren't doing degrees in science and painting because I was like, I need to make sure I do that. Then I get really good at painting, do really well at painting, and I kind of stop and I'm like, what's something? And that, like, let's just use comedy as an example. Like that's a thing that I'm like have never done as challenging. Mm-hmm. I'm alive. Why not try that? Now I'm trying to like write
because
things.
Don't you
it's
ever
like,
feel like I have this is obviously not a podcast about just being funny anymore in this last moment. We're probably gonna wrap up soon. I'm just like, I guess I have so much time anxiety. I'm like, I need to spend the time I have on this earth doing the things I actually like now instead of trying to do things that I don't necessarily know I like or and don't necessarily know are me authentically.
Whereas, which is totally fine. Whereas my thing is like, I think we're all capable of liking everything we do and I want to try different things because I want to know what about them I'm going to like or dislike. Like I actually think that after COVID I might not do quote unquote comedy ever again, and I'm so happy that I got to do it and realize what I liked about it and what I didn't like about it. Like there's only certain things, mainly science, in my life that I have gotten so into that I've been like, I still like this. And it's mainly actually nature. It's like the only thing that's like pulled through for me. And so I'm just like, I don't know what the next thing is I'm going to try and do really full throttle and then realize I like or don't like. I don't know what I don't like right now. I need to do it to know what I won't like.
Well, philosophy 101, girl.
Is it? Like, I'm like, does that make sense?
No, it does make sense. It is just, I think, related to our innate personalities. Yeah. Or the way we were conditioned.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I don't know if there's like a genetic component. There probably is at some element.
I mean, it's therapy, so it comes down to our parents. It comes down to really? Our genes and the way we were truly. Raised. And our teachers.
Okay. Well, very interesting conversations.
I can just picture someone like who has been washing the dishes and stopped and being like, what the hell are they talking about?
Like laughing, and then being like, oh, like we're going here. Okay. Like we're going into like their therapy conversations. Okay. Thank you guys so much for listening. What else is going on?
A lot of these podcasts are related to ASAP Science videos. So whether it's out or not, we're doing a video called The Funniest Joke in the World Statistically. Watch it.
We're doing a video about lots of different things. Every podcast is often related to a video, but often
it helps get our brains flowing on the studies. It's like if you want to know the thought process behind this, that's it. We love y'all.
Yeah, love y'all. Thank you so much for listening. Rate and review if you can on iTunes and any podcast app that you're using, because that's apparently like a very useful thing. And thank you so much. We love to hear from you. So message us on Twitter, Instagram, wherever you want, and we'll see you next week. Bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.